Couture, 2009-13-64. Please proceed, Mr. Flannery. You can be sure we will hear everything you have to say.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kevin Flannery for Appellant Hearing Components, and this case comes to us from a trial of issues to both the jury and the bench in the Eastern District of Texas, whereby all issues were decided in favor of Hearing Components on the 076 and 151 patents. And there was, prior to the trial, there was an issue of claim construction that was decided on the 920 wax guard patent.
You had contrary verdicts after the JMOL on the straight nozzled and the bob nozzles.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
But wasn't there a good reason for that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think on the straight nozzle, as we've discussed in our brief, there was instances whereby it was clear that the judge did not understand misunderstood the evidence that was presented. I
mean, what was the structure corresponding to the claim function?
Okay. The structure, I think that's best illustrated on page 35 of the blue brief. There is, if you look at the page 35 of the blue brief, in the middle, there's an illustration whereby there is some structure above a connecting portion where that structure does not go the full length of the connecting portion. Okay, I think if Shore's device were like that, we wouldn't be having this discussion here because it would be clear that there's structure.
Is the structure then for the attachment means just the surface of the straight nozzle?
No, Your Honor. If you go to page 21 of the blue brief, I believe it's color highlighted in. It's either yellow or pink.
Why don't we refer to documents in the record rather than argumentative?
I think
formulations.
Page 21 of the blue brief is a document in the record, Your Honor, and that is Shore's engineering drawing. Okay, so the structure, to go back to your question, Judge Rader, the structure in Shore's nozzle is that significant portion that's color highlighted in yellow. So that structure, the portion, if that
that's
portion,
the surface, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, that's literally half of the nozzle structure itself. If that structure did not exist, the sleeve would fall off of the nozzle.
In other words, if you had a narrower nozzle.
Correct. If the yellow structure did not exist, so if the nozzle was just the outer diameter was the encompassed by what is shown in red, the sleeve would fall off.
Your case is that the claimed invention and the two Shore products, the smooth and the barbed, work on an interference fit basis, right?
Yes, Your Honor. There's interference fit in the patent specification. There's additional structures as well as interference fit, but there is an interference fit with the barb design. You have a hard plastic barb, some portion of that going into and engaging a soft plastic duct.
Let me ask you just one question, if I could, on one of the figures in the patent. I think it's figure 5. Since we're in a means plus function here, we have to, I guess, look at the figures and the structure there. Figure 5 seems to be, and maybe I'm wrong, but as best I can tell, it's the one figure in the patent that doesn't show any kind of a tube. Am I right here that in this figure 5, the screw goes right into the foam?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. So there's no duct there, so that would not be covered.
Duct, that's what I meant.
The soft plastic duct, as shown in figure 4 above, for example, where the ball engages the socket, the ball is hard plastic, and it engages the soft plastic socket. That socket is soft plastic duct. That duct does not exist in figure 5. but as is the case
so
in the
So there goes right into the foam, just with no break between the foam and the screw, no duct.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then how would it be detachably attached? Would you just unscrew it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the way it would work. So as described in the specification, with respect to that one, because of the certain pitch and the characteristics of the screw thread, it was designed such that the sleeve would not fall off and be left behind in the user's ear. But returning to the focus to figure 4, there is an interference fit there. And again, then returning back to the Shure engineering drawing at page 21 of the blue brief, that structure highlighted in yellow, as I've indicated, if that structure was not present in the Shure device, the sleeve would fall off. So that is the structure that is intentionally placed into the nozzle. And that structure emanates from a connecting portion.
But if we're talking about fastening means, we look to column 3 of the patent that talks about screw threads and a ball and socket attachment. And I think somewhere there's adhesive. And all of those involve a kind of friction or resistance, whereas the smooth instrument on which the court granted the JMOL is quite different from what's disclosed.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I do believe it is different. However, I don't think it's quite different, and I don't think it's substantially different. That structure, that additional structure, that structure in yellow, engages, that's hard plastic, it engages the soft plastic duct. And I would submit to Your Honor that it engages that soft plastic duct in the same manner as the ball, the hard plastic of the ball, engages the soft plastic duct.
Tell us about the invalidation of the 920 patent for indefiniteness.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. The 920 patent is directed to the wax guard, and
now, here you've got vague language, and of course patents are often upheld even when there's vague language in the claim. But you've got a district judge, a very capable district judge, who said, I can't figure out where this is definite, how I'm to know where the dividing line is. How can we reverse that?
I think Your Honor can reverse that by concluding that the district judge went too far with his claim construction. He queried himself whether he could stop at the construction that would indicate that the wax guard can be used without tools or specialized skills. And that was a basis for distinguishing the wax guard over the prior art. I believe that the district court made a mistake by then going further and analyzing whether any certain class of a certain group of people, such as people with infirmities of their fingers that can't handle things well, whether they can actually use it without tools or specialized skills. But that was not necessary for the district court judge to go that far. Indeed, there was no distinguishing of prior art based upon whether some group...
Does this claim have to be interpreted differently depending upon the age and physical capabilities of the wearer? If you've got a 70-year-old person with a hearing aid, he or she can probably handle it quite nicely. You've got a 95-year-old person, it might not be readily installed.
I think they all can, Your Honor, if the test is it necessary for them to use tools or specialized skills? And essentially the specialized skills is talking about some type of professional who's used to working with hearing aids or the like. So if you stop the test if the test for infringement is stopped at whether it can be used without tools or specialized skills, then I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that any person...
But none of that appears in the claim. The claim just says in very vague language what it says.
Well,
readily installed and replaced.
I think it becomes a matter of claim construction. So in other words, the court has routinely instructed us that we're not trying to find indefiniteness in the claim. We're looking for some construction to render it such that it's not insolubly ambiguous. And if you look at the specification and the prosecution history, the reasonable interpretation of that term is that it can be used without tools or specialized skills. So I agree it doesn't say that in the specification, but in the claim. But I think it becomes a routine issue of claim construction. And when we look at that issue of claim construction, is can it be construed to a point where it's definite? I submit that it is, whereby it can be used without tools or specialized skills, and there's no need to go any further to construe it, as was done by the district court.
Stanley, let me ask you one question, if I could.
Please.
If we disagree with you, obviously we would affirm that the 920 patent is gone, it's indefinite. However, if we agree with you and say that this term is not unconstruable, so to speak, should we send it back to the district court to construe, or would you want us to construe it?
I think the construction that I would ask Your Honors to construe it, I think the district court did query that he could do, that it can be construed to be can be used without tools or specialized skills. I think the issue is here. It's ripe for decision. You would look at claim construction de novo. So I think as a matter of
this position, would require a new trial?
We didn't have a trial on the 920 patent, Your Honor. So then we would have to go back. And we certainly, if Your Honors were to construe it in that manner, we would have to go and then look at the issues of infringement and validity and damages. We did not get to any of that in the trial. So I'd like to, unless there's any further questions.
You know, maybe it's apparent to me that the district judge is narrowing the issues when he finds a way to eliminate this patent. Why wouldn't I on that basis sustain his judgment? He's doing his best to manage his workload and give you a fair trial on what he considers to be the most important issues, and he brushes this one aside. Is it fair for me to give deference to that kind of a potential decision-making?
Yes, I believe it is. It is fair, Your Honor, because it's fair to my client and it's fair to anybody who comes to the court on an issue of claim construction.
You're asking whether it's fair to give deference.
I understand that, but right. The issue is claim construction. And
I'm saying I could sustain the district judge because he brushed aside your wax-protecting patent using this indefiniteness because he thought he should focus on the other patent. So I'm actually arguing that for a form of deference that would cut against you.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I don't think that deference is appropriate, at least as I've read the scores of claim construction cases that have come down, and whether there should be deference. As far as I understand the law right now, there is not deference. So.
Yeah, but I think it's a different kind of deference Judge Rader's talking about. The cases address the question of deferring to a judge's or a district court's construction of a particular term in a claim. Judge Rader, I think, is talking about something else. He's saying, should we defer to a docket management kind of decision by the district court to narrow the issues in the case?
Sorry for not letting you
finish. No, I think I'm finished.
I respectfully submit that it's not fair to do that when the claim construction is wrong. If Your Honors feel that the claim construction is wrong, then I don't think it's appropriate for the district court to then say, well, even though I've got the wrong claim construction, because I want to manage my docket and this patent doesn't seem to rise to the level of the other patents as far as importance in the case, then I can just dismiss it.
Were there other issues of invalidity raised and argued below that the court didn't deal with because it acted on the basis of indefiniteness?
No, Your Honor. Not on the WaxGuard patent, Your Honor. On the other patents that we had to trial on, but not on the WaxGuard patent.
In other words, if we agree with you, there's nothing to remand on with respect to the validity of that patent because there weren't other issues pushed aside.
There were not other issues pushed aside, but I assume that Shore would tell you that they would still reserve the right to challenge validity on obviousness or anticipation grounds, by all means.
We've used up most of your rebuttal time. We'll give you 5 minutes in rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
Mr. Kugelman. Since we're talking about the indefiniteness issue, 920 patent. That would seem to be an awfully minor ground to knock out a patent on, wouldn't it?
I don't think so, with all due respect, Your Honor. I think the judge below gave ample consideration to the indefiniteness analysis. And
well, I'd repeat that question and add one further query. How is this insolubly ambiguous? I can see ambiguity. They're broad terms, but it's not insoluble. One of skill in this art certainly knows how to install and replace these features.
And there's no question that someone of skill would be able to do that, but the issue hinges on the readily language, and that's the part of the claim language that makes it
insoluble. But the specifications rather... It isn't devoid of language on this. It talks about, well, you don't have to use tools, so we're not screwing it on and off with wrenches. We know it has to be hand done. And it's saying the user can do it without any additional help. You don't have to call your nurse to do it. It doesn't sound to me like that's insolubly ambiguous. I now know it's got to be something that snaps on and snaps off quite quickly and easily.
With all due respect, there's still the issue of these human factors that are involved. Who is the user? And how long does it take the user to put this on?
What's readily? You've always got the eggshell skull sort of problem in human activity. This is, of course, a user of ordinary capabilities in this field. I'm still struggling with how this is insoluble.
The user, the specification makes clear that there can be multiple types of users, and depending on age, it may make it more difficult or less difficult for someone to install these and take them off. Is 20 minutes readily installed for someone who's 90 years old, or is it 5 minutes, or is it 1 minute? And there's no objective metric in the specification.
But there's no way to do an objective measure. We've got case law that says that's one reason for not having indefiniteness. Because, as you point out, somebody who's 90 may take a good deal of time to do a simple snap procedure. Someone who's 60 can do it without any problem at all. And so you can't put in a measure. Well, it's got to be 5 minutes or 7 minutes or a sliding scale. There's no way to measure human performance.
Well, actually, Dr. Casale, who was an expert that Shure offered, did provide the court with testimony that there are ways. He's experienced in this art, and there are ways to measure this.
But that would cut against you. If someone of skill in the art can say, oh, I can figure this out easy, then it's not insoluble again.
It would only cut against us, Your Honor, if using these different ways, you'd come up to the same result. But that's not in the record at this point in time.
Mr. Goodwin, question on the 920, the same question that I asked Mr. Flannery. If we were to disagree with you, do you urge us to send the 920 patent back to the district court for construction, or would you urge us to construe this this term?
We believe that you can construe the term, that the parties have provided the court with the construction that's necessary. Okay. So I don't think there is a reason to send it back to the court
for
construction.
We review things. We are not a decisional body. Do you think it's appropriate for you to ask us to review something or to do something ab initio?
I do, Your Honor. This is, claim construction is an issue of law, and the court construes
claims
all the time.
But we review claim constructions. We don't do them. You don't think that's a distinction?
I do. I do think that is a reasonable distinction, Your Honor. The parties, however, have both put into the record their respective claim construction positions, and we believe that it does not need to be sent back to the district court for construction. There is a follow-up. Mr. Flannery is correct. With regard to validity issues, Shure does have invalidity as well as non-infringement positions, so there would still be questions of fact to be tried below on the 920.
Mr. Cooperman, not to take up all your time on this one issue, but we're struggling with being readily installed, et cetera. If you look at that claim, of course, every limitation is theoretically important. That's not all there is to this claim. Comprises, that's preamble, comprising a thin, flexible membrane that does this, one side of which is normally tacky and pressure-sensitive, adhesive layer, a portion of it overlying said outlet port, being porous and capable of waxing trap. In other words, there's a lot to that claim other than just this preamble language.
Well, right? there is a lot to the claim, Your Honor.
It's a structural claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead with your other argument.
briefly, Your Honor, on the straight nozzle issue.
Excuse me, let me ask you, and you're now talking about the infringement issue, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Flannery says, and it was the sense I got from the record of the expert for the plaintiff, that patented invention works on an interference fit basis, and it was the testimony, is it Dr. Chastin or Chastin?
Chazen.
Chazen, that the accused devices work on an interference fit basis. What is your view on this interference fit issue as to how the patent works and how your client's devices work?
The evidence is clear that it isn't simply an interference fit with the embodiments of the patent and the specification. It's more than that. Dr. Wood, our expert, testified there's this female matching structure that's required is the way to accomplish the 112.6 means.
Remember, we're dealing with no reasonable jury standard, and we've got the preeminent expert in this field, Dr. Chasen, saying a person of skill in the art would know to replace a ball and socket or a screw with this interference fit. It's just kind of a natural thing that would be suggested to them. Why isn't that substantial evidence and certainly enough to support a jury?
The known interchangeability alone under Chuminada is not enough to justify a verdict of infringement here. We had substantial evidence to the contrary from Dr. Wood that, again, the way that the specification describes the patented embodiments is substantially different. It's more than just a mere interference fit. It requires female structure, and it requires positive locking. This was digging into the way argument. And this was unrebutted by Dr. Chazen. So Dr. Chazen, who is an audiologist, focused on the audiological side of things. Dr. Wood, our expert, who's a mechanical engineer, focused on the way, under Section 112, Paragraph 6, these structures actually interacted with each other.
But still, the question is whether a skilled artisan would recognize this friction fit as an equivalent of any of the things shown to us in the patent, including a friction fit screw type figure 5 example. Why isn't that enough for the... Remember, it's a jury verdict.
Figure 5, Your Honor, was not at issue below. It was not. It does not correspond to any of the asserted claims below. Figure 5, as Judge Shaw pointed out, does not have a duct, the plastic duct. And all of Schur's accused products have a plastic duct. So that was not an issue below, nor was it asserted below. It's corresponding to any of the claims.
But it is corresponding structure.
It's corresponding structure for the claims that don't require a duct.
I mean, what we do have the testimony, I can't remember the precise, I was looking at it earlier. There is a part of Dr. Chasen's testimony where I think he looked at the screw with the duct in the patent and he looked at the ball and socket, and he went to some length to explain how this is a friction or an interference fit. And then he went to the accused devices, both I think the barb and the smooth device, and he said, we have the interference fit here. Now, I'll confess, when I first look at these things, you look at the smooth device especially, and you look at the drawings in the patent, you say, boy, these are different structures. But when you have that testimony from Dr. Chasen, and he keys right into the structure, and he keys it to the thing, to the accused products, and the jury agrees, I kind of find myself thinking maybe a little bit along the lines of Judge Rader, we have a jury verdict here. And isn't that substantial evidence?
I think I know which testimony you're talking about, Your Honor.
Let's see. It's at page...
Is it 3724?
I'm thinking about 3788 through 89.
3788. I think the bottom line of Dr. Chasen's testimony is while he used some of the magic language, he said structure once or twice. If you really dig down into what he did, he compared function, and that's fundamentally contrary to this court's precedent under Chuminada and under Toro. He mentioned the word structure, but then he goes on to talk about the function. That is not
enough. I don't
know.
Didn't he seem to be at those pages getting into it? He says the ball fits, and he talked about how it goes in there and some of the plastic and the duct closes around it a little bit. I mean, that seems to be saying the structure, how the structure operates. And then he talked about the accused device. I mean, maybe, you know, we could quibble about exactly what the testimony is, and you obviously have a better sense on the record than I do, but I just, even though my reaction was I look at these first blush and say, boy, these do seem different, but then when I get into this testimony, I'm kind of thinking, well, you know, here's an expert, and the jury bought it.
Yeah, and Dr. Chasen, again, doesn't have the technical experience that the Dr. Wood has, and in explaining the way.
He's an audiologist, I
correct.
Suppose.
Correct, Your Honor. Real briefly.
Well, let me point out to you, you're running down and you wanted to save a little time. And if you come back again, it'll be to rebut your opponent
yes.
on the cross appeal if there's anything to rebut. So you can make your
yes, thank
decision.
Switching to our cross appeal topics, the district court erred in denying JMOL on Schur's obviousness defense. And this should be reversed for at least three reasons. First, HCI's supposed evidence concerning the teachings of the prior art actually contradicted the express teachings in writing. Second, HCI's claims are nothing more than a combination of known elements. It's a classic case under KSR. And third, the jury verdict of Schur's barbed earphones infringing is inconsistent with the record that shows a prior art barbed product did not invalidate. And then with regard to latches, Your Honor, it should also be reversed because the court ignored this court's precedent.
What did it ignore?
Ignored the Wanless case with regard to evidentiary prejudice, Your Honor, and the ABB case with regard to economic prejudice.
We'll give you your full 2 minutes. In fact, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Flannery. Excuse me.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to return to the discussion of the evidence on the way and picking up on what Judge Schall was saying. There was Dr. Chasen, you were right, he did go to the structure evidence. Schur has repeatedly tried to say, well, we're just focusing on function. Well, that's easy to say. It's easy to say in the context of a 112.6 analysis. But the issue was there substantial evidence that was presented to the jury? And that's the issue. And Dr. Chasen was qualified as an expert. They didn't challenge his qualifications as an expert to testify on this subject. And we've cited in our brief the pages, and I'm not going to belabor it, more than saying there was clear evidence on the way showing how the structure, as you indicated, there's hard plastic structure that is in the shore nozzle, and it's not just the surface, referring back to Judge
Who
Rader.
Is a better person to decide if this jury was reasonable than the district judge who sat there and examined them for the days of the trial?
Well, I don't think the judge ever questioned Dr. Chasen's ability to look at this issue, to decide whether there was...
I'm kind of asking a different question. I'm going to kind of the overall judgment of the district court that his jury acted unreasonably. Well, and isn't that something within his capability?
Your Honor, I have the utmost respect for the district court judge, but I believe in this instance, as we pointed out in our brief, that he misunderstood the evidence. So, for example, if his basis, one of his primary basis for concluding that after watching the evidence, one of his primary bases is that Dr. Chasen didn't do the proper analysis because he didn't consider the engineering drawings, Shore's engineering drawings. I mean, the district court judge said that. So, but it's very clear that Dr. Chasen considered the engineering drawings. There was considerable time spent on Dr. Chasen's analysis of the engineering drawing. That page 21 of our brief is analysis of an engineering drawing where Dr. Chasen showed how the Shore nozzle has this structure and how it engages with, has this structure in the nozzle, and how that structure, that means attachment structure, engages with the soft duct. So I don't know what the disconnect was.
If he misunderstood it at trial after listening for days and days, what are our chances of understanding it on appeal in 10 minutes?
I think your chances are when you look at the appropriate standard of review, which is whether there's substantial evidence in the record, and as Judge Shaw has pointed out, we have an expert who focused on the structure and the way in which that structure exists on the Shore device and the way in which that structure exists in the claim in the specification. Again, I don't know what the trial court's disconnect was with the evidence, but if your question is, well, why can't we defer to the trial court who sat there and watched that, I have difficulty doing that when the trial court says that Dr. Chasen did not even review Shore's engineering drawings. So again, I have the utmost respect for the judge. And there were other circumstances to show that he misunderstood the evidence.
Your position is that it's the friction interference fit. If you follow that to its logical conclusion, if you're right on that, are you saying that you should win on both patents, but if you're wrong on that, you lose on both?
We win on both.
If one says there's an interference friction fit, you'd say we win on both, but you then have to say that if it's not interference or friction fit, we lose on both.
But I don't understand. There's nobody's disputing that there's interference fit in the patent specification and that Shore's device has interference fit. So I'm not fully comprehending your question when there's no dispute that there is.
Oh, no, I understand that.
Okay.
But I don't know, maybe Mr. Cooperman would dispute it. But if one says these things don't work on interference fit, you would lose on both, you would say, right?
Yes.
But if they do work on interference fit, you win on both, right?
Yes.
And that's your view.
And it doesn't. And Mr. Cooperman is probably going to come and tell you that, well, in the hearing component specification, it's just partly interference fit. But according to their expert, you have to have more than that. Well, there's nothing required in that in the court's claim construction, and there's nothing required in that in the specification. So what I'll call the extra factors that Dr. Wood pointed out, Shore's expert, positive locking, female and male structure, those were not required by the specification, not required by the court's claim construction, and the jury was free to disregard those. Thus bringing us back to the central issue, is there substantial evidence? There is substantial evidence to support an interference fit in the patent specification, and there is substantial evidence to support an interference fit in the Shore devices. I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Flannery.
Thank
Mr.
You.
Cooperman has
nothing really to
a few minutes. I'm sorry? Has a few minutes on to rebut on cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Flannery was discussing whether or not there was structural testimony. Your Honor's asked about that. I think the key here is in order to sustain the jury verdict, we need something more than simply a conclusion without support by an expert that there is structure there. And if you look at, for example, A3724.
Is this cross appeal or is this principal appeal?
This relates to, I believe, both.
I guess one of each.
Our cross appeal, yes, Your Honor.
All right, stick to
it's
cross appeal.
It's cross appeal to the extent the barb device is involved.
Right. Yes, right. Yes, okay. It is, Your Honor. If you look at A3724, though Dr. Chazen says that he believes they're structurally equivalent at page 10, he uses that magic word structure, he then goes on to talk about it as not a substantially different function. And he does drill down into, to some extent, the ball and socket, as Your Honor's pointed out before, but that ball and socket isn't the ball and socket of the specification. He actually changes it to a hypothetical structure, Your Honor. So he's not actually comparing the structures disclosed, he's comparing yet another unknown structure with Schur's actual structures. And real briefly, Your Honor, again,
But he says his conclusion is pretty clear. The ball and socket implementation is not significantly different from the barb that we see in the Schur products. He's not speaking function there. He's speaking structure.
I think.
And he's using the right words. Significantly different.
He's speaking in conclusions, and if you drill down, if this is enough. Then
well,
any,
back
any
up
conclusion.
Starting that question, he says they're structurally equivalent. The differences are insignificant, unsubstantial. He seems to be addressing exactly the question he's supposed to address.
He's using the magic language, I agree, Your Honor, but it's, again, in conclusory form without an explanation of the way, which is what Section 112, Paragraph 6 requires.
Thank you, Mr. Cooperman. We've heard you both. The case will be taken under advisement.